This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. So, where's your go-to coffee spot? All right, what kind of car do you drive? Now, name your favorite TV show. And you're listening to public radio, so you voted for... Anyway, the answers to those questions may reveal more than just your habits. They could unlock clues to your worldview and how you vote. In their new book, Prius or Pickup, political scientists Mark Hetherington and Jonathan Weiler dig into how answers to seemingly inconsequential questions can help us understand America's growing political divide. They also explore how Americans reach the point where being on the left or right is no longer an opinion, but an identity. Jonathan is director of undergraduate studies and a professor of global studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Thanks so much for having me, Frank.
Also with us is Mark, who is the Raymond Dawson Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Frank. It's good to be here.
Good to have you here, Mark. Break down this idea. There are the book itself centers on this idea of how different people perceive the world, this worldview, and it really comes from research that interested both you and Jonathan from a couple of decades ago. Break this down for us.
Well, the basic idea is this. You know, back when the three of us were all growing up, the thing that really divided Americans into different political parties was an idea, a philosophical idea about how big the government ought to be. You know, should it provide more programs? Should it provide fewer programs? And the divide between Republicans and Democrats was along those lines. Democrats thought more, Republicans thought less, but this was something that people could compromise across. And more important, maybe, is that people weren't real experts about this type of a thing. But what's happened over the last 30, 40 years is that the dividing line between Democrats and Republicans has changed to be one that's about something that we do care about, something deep down inside of us, what we characterize as our worldviews. And that center part of worldview is the idea that the world is either on the one side of the political divide, a dangerous place that we need to hunker down against, or on the other side, that it's an interesting place for us to explore. And now that the world of politics turns on that distinction, the feelings that we have about politics are so much stronger. No longer are we divided about a philosophy of governing. Instead, we're kind of divided about a philosophy of life, you know, something that everybody has.
And this question of flux, of whether you believe that the world is an interesting place full of mystery that we should explore and be open to, or a dangerous place that we need to more or less close ourselves off from and protect ourselves, Jonathan, there was some research several decades ago that asked questions that sort of got at what kind of an individual you were, or sort of more or less what your worldview might be, right?
Yeah, that's right. And the questions that we use, they're not questions that we came up with. They have evolved over several decades, are questions about how people think children should be raised, what qualities they think it's most important for children to have. So, for example, people are asked, do you think it's more important for children to have good manners or to be curious, or to respect elders, or to think for themselves? And, you know, typically, Frank, when people see these attributes, their first response is, well, of course, I want them to have both, right? I want my kid to be curious, but I don't want them to be a disgusting slob when I take them out to eat in a restaurant. What's interesting, though, is that when we force people to make a choice and to prioritize which of those characteristics they think are more important, that reveals a great deal about our worldview and in turn about our politics.
Well, talk about those correlates. Mark, maybe I'll ask you this question about the way this correlates then to political opinion.
Sure. You know, the thing that is so fascinating is the answers to these four seemingly disconnected questions from politics is people's answers to those predict, explain, or highly correlated with our opinions about our racial attitudes, our attitudes about gender, our attitudes about immigration, our attitudes about how best to deal with terrorism, our attitudes about gun control. I mean, you can choose pretty much any hot-button political issue, and those answers to four questions about desirable qualities in children are highly predictive of people's opinions about whether they're in favor of gay rights or opposed to gay rights. And you can go across the entire gamut of of culture war type issues. And our magic items about parenting seem to be able to tell us a lot about where people stand on every single one of those things.
But Jonathan, I have to tell you, I don't find this correlation terribly surprising. I would think that if someone, you know, wants to raise their child to be polite and obey orders and is worried about the outside world, that they, want to have a gun in their hand, that they're worried about people who don't look like them. I mean, this doesn't surprise me too much. Do you think this reflects much of a change? Had we done this in 1910, would we get the same result?
Yeah, so good question, Frank. I think the distinction that's important to make, I think there's two distinctions to make. One is that 50 or 60 years ago, there was no difference of opinion on gay rights because it wasn't really an issue in politics, right? And actually, a lot of what we're talking about are now politically contested because there's a choice in the matter in ways that weren't true previously. So I think this distinction is important for understanding modern politics for that reason. But there's a second important point to make here, which is that even 25 years ago, you were as likely to find, we use the terms fixed and fluid, you were as likely to find fixed Democrats as fluid Democrats and as likely to find fluid Republicans as fixed Republicans. And so worldview 25, 30, 40 years ago didn't reveal our partisanship in the same way that it does now. So it's the sorting process. It's the process by which people who answer these four parenting questions differently have now sorted themselves out into the Democratic and Republican parties that's given our partisan divide its incredibly intense and acrimonious character.
So, Mark, what do we think has happened? I mean, it strikes me then, and we've said this before, I think the idea that now your political party has become an identity, that it's fixed, it can't change because it's annihilation if it goes away. You're gone, right? So if that's true, if this correlates to identity more than child rearing, what's happened in the meantime, and how was it that we were a little more fluid about our party affiliation 25 years ago?
Well, this is an extraordinarily important question to have the answer to, and it really lies in what divided us. You know, as Jonathan, you know, rightly pointed out, this worldview didn't separate us into Republicans and Democrats back in the day. What divided us into whether we were Republicans or Democrats was how big we thought the government ought to be and how many government programs there should be to, you know, deal with the inequalities that were present in life. But the fact is, you know, that how many government programs, this thing, that thing, a little bit more, a little bit less, people don't know the details, you know, of politics. How can you be, you know, really, really intense in your feelings about something that you don't really know very much about? Contrast that with, you know, how we feel about and understand, you know, these decisions that we make in life, you know, the fundamentals of, you know, is the world safe to explore? Is it something that we ought to hunker down against? The stakes that are tied up in an identity based on that are just going to be much, much more intense because the stakes are much higher for people if the other side sees the world in a different way. I mean, think about this. If you're a, you know, a more fixed worldview person who, you know, sees the threat of terrorism as or refugees coming into the country as particularly intense, and the other side of the political divide wants to invite those people into the country, that other side is, they're dangerous under circumstances like that. Compare that with another time when that other side just wanted to spend more money on the Department of Education. They're not dangerous. You just disagree with them.
Well, Mark, Jonathan, let's talk about when this divide took place and what is it in our political landscape and political dialogue that began, that sent us on this path. You trace it back to the 1968 Nixon campaign.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, for decades up till 1968, Republicans were mostly losing elections. And so they faced a very basic political problem. How do we break the stranglehold of the New Deal coalition on American politics? And a bunch of advisors around Richard Nixon, including a young Pat Buchanan and Kevin Phillips, decided that among the things we can do is to appeal to folks we used to refer to as blue-collar ethnic voters. We now call them white working class, who they thought perhaps on the basis of their resentment about the civil rights movement and other social changes that were taking place in the 1960s, could be sheared off from the Democratic coalition. And this is an important point, Frank, because the Nixon campaign wasn't, they didn't ask themselves, how can we attract authoritarian-minded or fixed voters? They only asked themselves, how can we win this election? But what they did was set in motion through the Southern Strategy and Law and Order and Silent Majority. They set in motion a process whereby both parties increasingly took opposite sides of these basic cultural issues, which again weren't feminism, changing family structure, gay rights. These weren't contested issues before the 60s and 70s. But once they were, the two sides staked very different claims about them, and that set in motion a process whereby worldview became central to our politics.
They were probably contested in that there were lots of protests, but they may have crossed party lines in terms of where you fell on this.
That's right.
But it was, and of course it goes back to 64 with the Goldwater debacle, when the Republican Party noticed that for the first time ever they were actually winning elections in the Deep South, and that is when one journalist who was privy to the Republican National Committee meeting in the immediate aftermath reported that the Republican Party has become, in fact, if not in name, the party of the white man. Which is to say, and this is the question I ask you, they had data that told them that these cultural issues are far more important than we ever believe.
They did have hints of this. And, Rick Perlstein, the great historian who's been writing about the racial divide in America for a long time, including books about Nixon land. His first book was about Barry Goldwater, and it's, the subtitle is The Unmaking of the American Consensus, that even at the depths of Republican despair in 1964, there was a recognition that there was perhaps a new divide to be explored. And George Wallace, who, of course, was a Democrat, was test marketing highly divisive racial appeals and appeals to crime and law and order as key issues also in 1964. So the DNA for our current political system is certainly traceable to that era.
But Jonathan Wyler, as the professor, Mark Hetherington, as a political science professor, I mean, this is what you get with democracy, right? You try with ever more accuracy and a finer scalpel to find those things, those issues that can bring you favor to voters. I mean, this is what democracy gives you, does it not?
This is exactly what democracy gives you. One of the things that's interesting and what we trace is that these issues that don't necessarily seem on the surface like they ought to have anything in common, why should, somebody's position on, what the best way to deal with terrorism or refugees, why should that have anything to do with their opinions about feminism or even their opinions about race? But the fact of the matter is that they do. And what we've identified, and I think the thing that is most important, is that what we've identified is the core thing that ties people's ideas, their preferences, the way they feel about all of these issues together. And it's this deep down inside worldview, that they have. And it's not, we certainly aren't making an argument that, one side is nefarious for having, raised these issues. As you point out, it's politics. But what we're trying to identify is why has politics become so acrimonious over the course of our lifetimes. I mean, when Jonathan and I, and I'm sure you were growing up, politics just didn't feel like this. But now it really does. Our big worry in political science was people not caring enough back in the 2000s. In the 21st century, now it's all of a sudden that they care too much. And, the story that we tell is why, that evolution has taken place. And at the center of that is how we're divided.
Well, is there a way through this? Because if you think about that bedrock worldview, let's say you're really afraid of what's happening as people cross your border. You could make the argument to those people that if you don't want them to cross your border, you may need a more enlightened foreign policy that would make life better on the other side of that border. If there were something we all could do to make their lives better, they wouldn't be here because they'd rather be home speaking their native language. Is that an appeal you could make to a person who's afraid of seeing people who don't look like them cross their border? And since And let me just take it one step further. I think the appeal has been made and doesn't seem to be working. Is it because it's not effective or because fear is stronger than hope? I mean, where do you see us falling on that question?
Yeah. Fear is stronger than pretty much anything when you get right down to it. And when you think about human beings in general, I mean, think about climate change. Here's an issue where people aren't really thinking so clearly, or at least, you know, people who tend to experience concerns about the present day, they're not really seeing the long-term future of this. Human beings are really bad at taking stock of what might happen in the future. So any argument that says, well, we need to, you know, work on the system and the system will, you know, solve this problem, that's not going to work. That's not going to make people who are, you know, hardwired to understand the world as a pretty dangerous place. They're not going to take a whole lot of comfort in that approach to things. You know, the sad fact is, you know, this is a divide that is going to be very difficult to displace. And, you know, our story is frankly not an especially happy one. You know, not only are we seeing this divide taking hold of American politics, you know, we're seeing it happen in Europe. We find that these same four questions about parenting predict people's voting about Brexit, predict people's voting for right-wing populist candidates like the AfD in Germany and the National Front in France. Bolsonaro's big victory in Brazil is also a function of these same attitudes. This is you know, what's behind right-wing populism everywhere. And the best hope of changing things is for our political leaders to take a different tack, to divide us up differently. I mean, remember, the reason that worldview didn't matter in the New Deal era was because political leaders had us divided differently about how big government ought to be. And I think we see Democrats trying to do that a little bit more in 2018.
Yeah, but John, let me ask you that. You just said healthcare, and I talked over you. You said healthcare might be the issue that brings us together. It certainly has been a divisive issue up until now. And of course, it's in your best interest to keep people divided. It may be one party's best interest to keep people away from the polls. We've seen that. That keeping people interested, that suppressing the vote might be more important than encouraging people to vote. If it's working for you, why would you do that? And let me ask you this, Jonathan, I'll put this question to you. You talked about, Mark talked about in the New Deal, it wasn't the leaders who had us divided over those questions of big and small government. The issues, it was a depression and two solutions that were, you know, seemed to be the only obvious manageable solutions. So I don't know that leaders have done that, taken that kind of lead and risked their own political career to change the discourse?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think part of what you're, so two things, Frank. One, you're absolutely right that circumstances are incredibly important. As it happens in the conclusion of our book, our quote-unquote, I'm putting this in air quotes, optimistic scenario is that climate change will become so disastrous that it will force a kind of realigning of our interests. That's our optimistic scenario. So circumstances matter. But the other thing I do want to say about leaders is it's a good question whether they, in a positive direction, can induce a better way of thinking about politics. But in a negative direction, we know they can do that. I mean, the immigration issue in Europe now is gaining traction everywhere. And the fascinating thing about that is it doesn't matter what the actual immigration levels are in the given country, whether it's Denmark or France or Germany or Sweden or Hungary or Czech Republic, that issue is working, whether there's lots of immigrants or almost none. And so I think that's part of what we're thinking about when we think about leaders for ill being able to induce the kind of divide they want, and perhaps overly optimistically hoping that if that's the case, then they could take a different tack in a different direction.
Or the people can do that because they've taken over both parties in this country. The Democrats and Republicans were asleep at the switch, and we saw what happened when people began to take over their party. So maybe that.
Maybe that, yes.
Yeah, but that may be for good or for ill. Well, we'll have you back when you write your next book. Jonathan Weiler, Director of Undergraduate Studies and a Professor of Global Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Mark Hetherington, the Raymond Dawson Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for information on their book, Prius or Pickup, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, how lemurs may help us with space travel. Maybe they organize themselves better than we do. We'll find out. Stay tuned.